Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Michael.
Just a minute. I forgot to turn on my camera. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, and you?
I'm learning how to sail the pandemic, to use your metaphor about sailing. There seems to be a lag in your video feed.
Oh, yeah, I don't have a really wonderful internet connection here.
That's fine.
Mainly because I refuse to use Comcast.
Okay.
I just don't like their ethics as a company.
Well, and that's to be I commend you for taking that into consideration. I try to stay away from as much Google as I can.
Yeah, I've pretty much stayed off of Facebook.
Yeah.
I first I was really like, oh wow, this is really good people. Okay, this happened yesterday, a couple days ago.
Yeah.
Zoom kind of needed to get itself stabilized. I think there must be, like a lot of meetings that start at 10 o'clock.
Yeah, there's ever since the pandemic, there's a traffic jam happening a lot.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed the cafe on Tuesday. I like was what was being brought forward.
Oh, great. So you had a chance to watch the video.
Yes, I
Just
did.
you
Yeah,
were
because
yeah.
I want to get caught up to speed if I was going to attend the workshop.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you for doing that. 'Cause we are going to
Hey, buddy.
Hey.
Yeah, Lisa must have got knocked off. She's working with that, her internet connection.
Okay. I'll be right back.
Okay.
Right. Michael, remind me where you are again.
I am in the Inland Empire where you almost attended UCR, Riverside, California.
Oh, right. Right, right.
You almost came
Yeah.
here. You almost came here.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm in. It's interesting. I'd kind of frame things geographically of where people at, and I'm in the low desert, and a lot of people are up in the mountains and terrain, so it's kind of interesting the geography of our locations.
Yeah. In the article by Guy Deutscher, did you have a chance to read that?
I did read that. I found it very interesting. Some of the stuff, like any of it, a lot of us, I found a lot out of it, but some of it I'm going, I couldn't totally, it didn't stick, but a lot of things stuck of what he was saying.
Yeah, well, he's written a couple of books that are interesting, and one of them he talks about some tribes that You know how we orient subjectively, like we say, if we're giving somebody directions, you know, go down two blocks, make a right, go to the next stop sign, make a left, and you'll see it. There are tribes in the article. He talked about one that orients entirely by compass points. But then there are others that he talks about in his book that orient to the geography. You know, like if there's a mountain nearby, everything's oriented to the mountain.
Yeah, that's one of the things that stuck. I've never been good at north and south, so I've been good as far as in terms of the local geography, how to get around, you know, markers.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was one of the things that stuck that I found really, really fruitful for this notion of language and how it's tied to the land, I think.
And in native languages, even more so.
Yes. Yes.
So, hi, Rick. Hi, Misha. Hey, Marco. How you all doing today?
All right. Busy. My teaching starts tonight and tomorrow. So I've been preparing for my lessons.
What kind of teaching do you do, Misha?
I actually teach French. Yeah, tutoring and Russian and French. Yeah, I'm teaching French part-time at the Chevonki organization. Main course semester. Every semester we have new students and they live in the woods and cabins, work on the farm, milk cows, so do like a lot of hands-on and wilderness trips, like all about nature, sustainable living, all that. Very cool.
So the language teaching is a part of a larger program.
Yeah, it's the, well, and they also do in the academic part, so they do all the subjects. I'm part-time French teacher. Yeah, small group.
That sounds like a neat environment for education.
Oh yeah, wonderful place. Yes, by the ocean, beautiful area.
Great. I went to a factory model school as a kid.
What is it?
I went to a factory model school.
Oh, what is that?
Well, just a building, you know, with classrooms.
Oh, okay, yeah, like most of them.
And all the students arranged in grids facing the teacher at the front with a blackboard behind her, usually her.
Yeah. Well, I went to a Soviet school where we had to wear uniforms, pioneer scarves and badges and march and think like everybody else. You are no better or worse than anybody else. You are just like everybody else, which was a good message, actually. But at the same time, we were suppressing our freedom of expression.
Wow. Well, I want to welcome everybody. Apologize for the Zoom instability. If you get knocked off, Zoom seems to just reconnect you right away. So hopefully now that it's a little after 10 o'clock, I've noticed this, that at the top of the hour is when Zoom seems to be a little unstable, like there's greater on and off traffic at that time. So today is going to be different. We're going to, we're going to try something that is not really easy. And it has to do with learning to see your own assumptions. I'm going to try a couple of different ways, a couple of different approaches to that. When you try to do this, just keep in mind that
No. She was talking about Zoom instability.
Yep. We lost her.
Yeah, okay.
On my side, it said that Lisa had low bandwidth.
Well, that's weird because I'm actually using my higher bandwidth internet connection.
And here we are trying to take language broadband on low
bandwidth. Yeah, right. I just love the ironies of life, don't you? Sometimes I imagine, I don't really believe like there's a God, like a person sitting up there, but I like to imagine if there were, God would be laughing his ass off at the irony down here.
Sometimes there isn't a better explanation.
Yeah. What I was saying was, it's going to take continued practice. I'll show you a few techniques, and it's just going to take sort of a mindful approach ongoingly to continue to uncover assumptions that you don't know you have. So get us into like a different headspace, like not an analytic one, but into just kind of more relaxed, embodied, this is workshop space. So let's do a guided, just a little guided meditation to get us into the realm of paradox and into our bodies and into just a whole different space. So get comfy. Close your eyes if you'd like. Take a deep breath in and just hold it for a couple of seconds and release it. And another one in. And release it. And this time when you take your breath in, follow the air into your lungs where it's picked up by your blood and carried to your muscles to be used to do things like wiggle your toes. And breathe in again and follow the air again into your body. This time noticing that it not only goes through your blood to your muscles, it becomes you. You breathe in the air, and the air becomes a part of you. Keep breathing normally, and move your focus now from inside your body to your skin. So imagine being like very, very small, microscopic, and sitting on the surface of your skin, in between your pores. And notice as you look around all the activity going on, sweat being released like little microscopic geysers. Molecules going in, molecules going out. Notice the feeling of pressure from the atmosphere, how it's pushing on the skin. And the skin is pushing right back, despite how porous it is. And you're sitting right in the middle of this pushing from one direction and pushing from the other direction. And you get to balance right between those two forces. Now attune yourself to an even more sensitive level and feel the vibrations from the atoms in your skin travel through the environment, out past your skin, into the air. And those vibrations run into the vibrations from atoms of other things. You know, the atoms of the chair you're sitting in. If you go farther out, maybe even the atoms of the wall of the room you're sitting in, and the books in the room. Can you feel that vibratory connectedness extend out maybe to other people in the building you're in, or to your neighbors in the next house? And as you blend and merge your vibrations from your atoms with the vibrations from the atoms of all these other things and people, sensing the expansiveness of your energy vibration, can you hold on nevertheless to your own uniqueness while your vibrations are interacting and dancing with those of others? Breathe into this special awareness of being you and everything and everyone else. Notice any thoughts you have about that, or notice the absence of thought and just feeling it. Now slowly bring your awareness back to your body, back to your breathing, in and out. And when you're ready, open your eyes. So does anybody want to share anything about where you went or what that internal experience felt like before we move on? Just unmute yourself and start talking.
As your voice slowly guided us through this visualization, I found my imagination and my body having a background Beatles song being played because it seemed to musically go with Day Tripper from the Beatles. And if you've ever watched Day Tripper and how they've animated the song, it seems like you were attuned with the Beatles music of Day Tripper. It was a day tripping kind of visualization, but into realms that you were pointing to, but kind of musically synced up.
You know, that's interesting. It's not Day Tripper that I tend to vibrate to. It's I Am the Walrus.
I love it.
I am you and you are me and we are all together.
Yeah, because it definitely, because of vibration, there's a natural link, at least for me, to music. So that's how I was affected and where I went.
Thanks. Anybody else? You don't have to.
I really enjoyed it. It was, I thought, shamanic. And I've done shamanic kind of journeying where you go out or go into some other kind of realm or dimension or plane or reality. But this one was like in, and instead of big, it was small. And it also, in a way, felt very realistic in the sense that everything was happening in real time. And it was imaginary. There was a participation of the imagination, but it was also something objectively experienceable, visible, like present. And I like the sensation of being like a pulsing sort of presence in a vast field. So like with, but still not completely lost in it, like having a center in a way, but a decentered center, a connected center. So there isn't like the periphery is not separate. It's there's a flow between the center and the periphery.
Yeah, exactly. Like a standing wave. You know what a standing wave is? Imagine, you know, like a ball that just pulses and the wave just goes out in all directions. But it also comes back in. So it's this pulsing out and pulsing in. And the pulses meet up with other pulses. That metaphor for me is really powerful for, you know, like how I understand my connection with this other stuff around me that, you know, I call reality.
Yeah, I was thinking about how my mind right now is preoccupied with my lesson plans and like anxieties about beginning, you know, new semester and all that. And I'm like, and I've been doing meditation for a long time, but my mind is, and I always think if I didn't do meditation, it would be a catastrophe probably at this point. Because it's really like that, my mind is so, I have probably diagnosed ADHD and my mind is so all over the place. And I think it also shows in the way I speak. I always like jump, you know, when I listen to myself, it like doesn't make sense, but in my mind it makes sense. But when you said about neighbors, I made an effort to come back and forget about everything. And then I've done a lot of Vipassana meditation. So right away I would go to sensations in my, you know, scan my body. And And it really helps once I start feeling the sensations to ground myself in the present moment. But the moment when you said about neighbors, I started thinking about how am I connected? Like I really like felt like it all went around, like all my neighbors. I started mentally thinking about my neighbors. And I live in a small town in Maine and people are very friendly. But I still started thinking about how connected I really am, what like superficial level and how I am separated and more, I separate myself from them more because of my preconceived notions. And I put myself, you know, I am an outsider and I always be outside. I have all these ideas but it was a good moment for me to reflect and think about oneness with others at this right here, right now. It was a good experience. Well, thank you for this meditation. Really helped me to come back to.
It's a useful one when you're going into, you know, a new place or I used to do this sort of thing before I'd go tango dancing. It almost like just kind of breaks down barriers between people. You could probably do some research and find that doing this sort of thing before dealing with people actually like helps to facilitate the interactions. Maybe somebody would have to do some research. Okay. So now that we're in this sort of space with each other, let's turn to kind of a foundation for, you know, where do our assumptions live? Are all of you familiar with, you know, like the 2x2 squares of what you know, and what you don't know, and that sort of thing? Yes, no, no? Okay, I'll go through it. I'll go through it then. So if you can imagine, you know, the two opposites of knowing and not knowing, and the combinations of all those things. On two levels, okay? So there's one level of things you know and there's one level of things you don't know. Then there's two levels of what you know, okay? So let's give some examples of things we know that we know. You know, Misha could say yeah, there you go. Exactly. He knows that he knows French. He knows that he knows Russian. You know, I know that I know how to dance tango. I know that I know how to cook. You know, and then there are things that we know that we don't know. I know that I do not know how to speak Russian. I know that I don't know how to fly a jet airplane. So there are domains that, you know, we don't know. And then there are domains of what we don't know, we know. Okay, and Socrates played around in this domain and said that, you know, people actually know stuff, they just don't know they know it. And so he would ask questions of his interlocutors to draw out what they've forgotten or what they didn't know, they know. You know, that's a process called meiosis. It's like midwifery. And then, let me just back up. I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. So this could also be stuff that you repressed. You know, what you don't know, you know. It could be repressed stuff, stuff that you've forgotten, but with the right stimulus, you could recall. Or stuff that has become so second nature to you that you don't have to think about it really in a conscious process anymore. So then the last category is really like your blind spot, and that's the one that we're really interested in. The what you don't know, you don't know. Okay, and often you realize that when you learn something that doesn't fit into those other categories. So you might not know that you don't know how to speak, you know, the Matsi's language, which is the one that Guy Deutscher talked about, because you've never even heard of it before. So it's much harder to, I mean, it's sort of like that whole area is just like a huge blind spot. And so how do we, you know, shed light on that blind spot? And not just about, you know, the kind of knowledge base, you know, knowing French, knowing how to dance, knowing how to, you know, whatever. Not just the knowledge-based stuff, but the stuff about yourself that you don't know, you don't know. The things that are in your own blind spot that sometimes, you know, other people can see very clearly, but you can't see about yourself. So we're going to try to dive into that. And like I said, it's not an easy thing to shine a light on, particularly if you're just trying to do it with yourself. It often helps to do it with other people because they can see things about you that you can't see about yourself. But first, let's, before I move on from that, so, you know, Jung called that your unconscious, Jung and Freud. Often this kind of ignorance of what we don't know about ourselves reveals itself in what Jung called our complexes. And it's my contention that our complexes are actually our psyche's way of, you know, trying to rattle the cage and say, you know, hey, here's something you're not seeing about yourself. And, you know, our complexes can have very destructive effects in our lives if we're not attuned to them and able to like deal with them. So after, that's going to be the second part of today's workshop. I'll show you a way to look at yourself and your complexes in order to be able to see those things that are hidden to yourself. So let's just take a look at some everyday assumptions that we make. you know, for example, this chair, you know, when I sat down on the couch, I assumed it would hold me. When I walk across the floor, I assume that the floor will hold me up, you know, and not just that, you know, it's not rotten wood that I'm going to fall through, but that the actual matter is solid and will support my weight. And so, you know, we do operate in the world as if, you know, actually we operate having to make a lot of assumptions just because otherwise, you know, if we couldn't assume, for example, that, you know, the electricity will work so that my Zoom will work here so that we can have this thing, or I assume that when I turn the faucet on, the water will come out. I assume that, you know, the car will start. And those sorts of things, just those kinds of assumptions help smooth our lives. But those really are not the kinds of assumptions that I'm talking about. So, let's look at, so it's more cognitive and conceptual assumptions, assumptions grounded in language, given, you know, the nature of this course we're doing, that we're going to look at. And I thought we'd try something together first by looking at just a quote by somebody else. And then we'll do that before we take on, you know, things of our own. So I found this quote in my Word a Day email. It's by Stephen Jay Gould, who is a biologist author. And it's kind of appropriate because it's talking about exactly what we're doing here. He says, "The most erroneous stories are those we know best and therefore never scrutinize or question." So you might want to just write that down just to keep it handy while we look through it. The most erroneous stories are those we know best and therefore never scrutinize or question. So let's just pick out, you know, some of the key words there. Starting with erroneous and stories. Thinking and knowing. Scrutinizing and questioning. So let's ask what we mean by each of these. What's an erroneous story? What's erroneous? You know, by erroneous stories, maybe he means a commonly held explanation for something. Like, why do things fall to the ground? You know, for a long time, it was thought that things fell to the ground because like was attracted to like. You know, this is Aristotle's theory of gravity. And, you know, things rise because they're attracted to air. Things that fall are heavier. They're attracted to earth. But now the story of gravity, you know, it's a force that pulls things toward the center of the earth. So this is our current story. Do we still question gravity? I don't know, maybe not in a real extensive way. You know, we might still be trying to understand how gravity fits in, you know, with the other forces, the strong force and the weak force. But we don't really question its role anymore and why apples fall to the ground. It's like, that's a story we've accepted, that there's this thing called gravity and it's a force. Okay, so now let's look at the term erroneous. and its opposite is something be like accurate or correct. So there's a dichotomy there. And under that dichotomy is the assumption that something is either erroneous or accurate. Sort of like, no, one or the other, but not. So now we're getting into a tacit infrastructure of language, namely this mutual exclusivity of opposites. And that shows up, you know, all over our language. But what if something could be both erroneous and accurate? Now, do you feel yourself bristling that? Yeah?
I don't know if I'm going to respond. But when you brought up the word erroneous, because I am a maintenance person and I have to work with my hands and I have to deal with this notion of erroneous or something's not quite right, you have to step back and look at the limitations. It's a limitation. Erroneous can lead you down to a road that you're not stepping back and going, wait a minute, this is something that I can work with, but I have to step back and look at, you know, take a water heater. I have to kind of step back and look at it with a view that's not, attached to the notion of being limited so that I can move. And by doing so, I'm actually questioning the story of how to approach the water heater that's broken. Does that make sense? You see what I'm, it's because I can go a water heater and I said, oh, thermostat this, and I go through a process of eliminating things. So to find the error and why it's broken.
If I may jump in, but there's something important about that water heater, which is that you can objectively validate whether or not it's working. So your story could be more or less, let me just say, associated with a fix that results in the objectively available like condition that the thing works and you get hot water out of it, right? So
okay.
It depends on what we're talking about.
Okay.
I think, right? Because there are some things like the nature of the soul where there are statements we can make which are both erroneous and accurate. Like there isn't the same kind of objective pragmatic reality. So
okay.
Correction to anything you're saying. That's like why.
No, I don't take it that way, Marco. I don't take it that way.
Okay.
Actually, I'm seeing how you're helping me with my probably assumption of staying with the practicality. And I feel you're enlarging it beyond the practicality.
Well, I think the practicality is really important because a lot of times we have a kind of category error where we're expecting certain kinds of statements to work in the wrong tool. You know, like you wouldn't use a hammer to screw in, you know, a deadbolt, right? Like, so we wouldn't make truth claims about like objective realities that we couldn't actually like validate, you know, like so. But we can make other kinds of claims that are maybe more suggestive or poetic or metaphoric, or and then we have to evaluate those kinds of like statements. We have to process them differently, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, and to your point, Marco, one of the things the brain does is it takes our understandings gained from concrete experiences and applies them to other kinds of experiences that are not necessarily as concrete. You know, so the metaphors from one realm, we export to other realms, and they might not be quite as applicable, but we apply them anyway. So it's watch out for when that happens.
Well, Lisa,
Go ahead.
On the erroneous stories, what struck me was that that assumes a basis of truth, that there has to be a foundation where to judge what is erroneous or not, based on some type of comparison, which is usually grounded in some kind of belief or foundational understanding, before you can say it's erroneous or not. So if I say there's an erroneous story, I'm saying that I know what the truth is, or I know how the water heater works. Therefore, I know there's something wrong with it because I have this foundational belief structure or whatever. And you can apply that to whether you want to talk about God or not. It's saying, well, my truth claim is that there is a God. I may or may not be able to prove it, but I'm making it based on what I believe. And here are the stories that I'm using to back that up. So that's just some thoughts that happened for me.
Lisa, you're muted.
I was just affirming that even, you know, goes right along with what Gould is saying. So truth, which is what you were just talking about, right, depends on knowing what is erroneous and what is accurate, so you don't go mixing them up. And I'm saying that, you know, sort of tongue in cheek, because we mix them up all the time. Nevertheless, opposition is an assumption that's often in our blind spot that we don't scrutinize or question. And indeed, it's often how children are taught. They're taught in terms of oppositions. You know, you play games with them. What's the opposite of stop? You know, what's the opposite of red? What's the opposite of up? And, you know, in one of the ways that we get into, I don't want to say trouble, but one of the ways in which our assumptions work is that we can assume that they're the information we have is the same across all contexts. Okay, so imagine playing a game with a kid and you're like, okay, what's the opposite of up? Down. Okay. In your local context, that applies pretty well, you know, across the board. If you zoom back to like a whole earth context, okay, and if you imagine somebody, you know, standing in Northern California pointing up, you know, and up is kind of going that way. I should have brought my globe, okay? And somebody in Australia is pointing up, and their up, you know, is actually like opposite that of the person in California. This is an example of a different context in which, up and down have different different relationships to each other. So it helps to look at how we teach children, particularly how we teach children language. And there we find lots of evidence of inculcating, you know, tacit infrastructures and assumptions and the like. So,
Can I add something that I will say it's personal? In teaching children language, one of the things from my experience, because I had a speech impediment, is the tension that adults... Can you hear me?
Rewind and say that sentence over because your audio went out.
Okay. I had a speech impediment, and when I was taught language, what I remember of that teaching that I'm trying to draw from what you just said is the extreme tension, I mean intensity that adults project on children in learning language. It's like, you've got to get this right. You know, you've got to get this fucking right. I mean, I'm drawn from my experience, and I think that's played into my interest and my frustration with language as a whole. So you just triggered something that I wanted to point to.
And we do the same thing in terms of teaching category structures too. You know, if you were a little kid and you know, told to, you know, draw some penguins, you know, and you didn't draw your penguins as black and white, you know, your teacher or parent or whatever would come over and say, you know, no, Lisa, penguins aren't green. Penguins are black and white. So those things, go ahead.
All right. Thinking of this right, it's that embodied experience in terms of this languaging and this where you're pointing to. I'm feeling it on an embodied experience, you know, and some of the, maybe we'll get to it, but some of the shadow work is how I work with that experience that's buried.
Yeah.
If I may, I think this, what you're pointing to, Michael, goes really deep because it's has to do with, like, I think the cultural assumptions that we make about the value and the function of education, and then the importance we place upon children learning the skills that they need to in order to become competitive, you know, participants and members of the society, where, you know, everybody's ranked in some way, you know, according to their abilities, all whatever characteristics, you know, both natural and acquired. And so that thing that you feel, that I know I felt too, is that you have to acquire language, you have to get good at it or gain a facility with using this tool. And we think of it as a tool. And there are other ways to think of it. It's also because the truth is that every human child, practically every human child without serious disability, like organic disability, just learns language just by being around other speakers. It's more of a, it's a medium, it's a milieu, it's an environment, it's like something that we swim in. Those are all metaphors, but more than it is a tool. But we can use it as a tool and relate to it as a tool. But when we do, that's because we're in an instrumental mindset. Like, we're already in a kind of relationship with language and with the world where we're trying to kind of get some result. Like, we want the water heater to work. You know, we want, like, we basically want our world to work, and we want to be able to, like, be a part of it and get our needs met and our wants filled. So I think that that's part of what is like the kind of the dynamics of the story. But then what if we like withdraw our energy and intensity from the mechanistic kind of instrumental way of relating and allow them to go into more of a contemplative or more of like present sort of embodied mode? And what different, like how would the field change of what we know and don't know, and know that we know and don't know that we don't know? Yeah. What would be disclosed that where the whole like equation of what's accurate information and erroneous would change because the field is different?
100%. I agree with you.
Yeah. Those are, thank you, Marco. That was beautiful. The assumptions, you know, if we think of language as a tool, are completely different than our assumptions if we think of language as the water we swim in, or the field we're operating in. The kind of little known philosopher by the name of R.G. Collingwood had a similar but slightly different take on this. He looked at statements and their logic in terms of you know, not just consisting of, you know, propositions the way we usually think of, you know, language in terms of you know, we make statements, X is Y. He said you have to look at them in terms of what question they're answering, which I found really kind of interesting. So any kind of, you know, proposition like the one we're considering here, this Stephen Jay Gould proposition, answers a particular question, and that if you're asking a different question, you would probably have to give a different statement or proposition or judgment. So, you know, we can ask ourselves what is the question that this quote is answering? So the quote again is, the most erroneous stories are those we think we know best and therefore never scrutinize or question. So it might be answering a question such as, you know, why do people have such obviously misguided beliefs? Or why do people have poor thinking skills? Or even, you know, which beliefs are people least likely to question? So basically he's saying there's a context. Did you want to say something, Rick? You kind of had that look of.
Well, I'm trying to think through this. Part of this to me is that the language establishes we use language to establish or communicate beliefs. And the assumed second nature beliefs that we have that are unscrutinized are the ones that we have been trained or inculcated into just accepting. All penguins are black and white. So when somebody challenges that, we don't think through. So our assumption is that all penguins are black and white, or all people are created equal, or something, whatever the statements are. They are belief structures that seem to be limited or developed by family, culture, society, religion, those kinds of things. And so those are accepted. And then the language is then used to reinforce that. And or then the point is, how do you unravel those assumptions that we make on a day-to-day basis that we don't even recognize that we're doing? That's what was going through my mind. Sorry.
And that's what a lot of our, you know, world is structured upon. I work with a lot of scientists, and they can be very good at both ends of the scale. They can be very good at you know, continuing to do things along the lines of, like, this is what we all know, we all believe, and, you know, like, keep investigating, you know, what makes a pigeon and not a crow? Why do pigeons, you know, do these funny little wing flaps? Why do they, you know, how do they metabolize the food they eat? Blah, blah, blah. And yet when they run into things that don't fit into their category structures, you know, that's when the excitement happens. And so I'm often telling my clients, you know, go looking for those things. For example, remember when mad cow disease was a big thing? One of the interesting things that came out of the scientists looking at mad cow disease was they found these things that are like proteins, okay, which proteins generally fall into the category of non-living. But these things involved in mad cow disease also had properties of living structures like viruses. And so they found this whole like new category of, they called them prions, which are like, they seem to be both in the unliving category and in the living category. Same thing with light, as both a wave and a particle. You know, like there was a category blurring there that had to be acknowledged. And you can even see it in a different way, like in the news. I watch Rachel Maddow a lot. That's how basically I get my news these days. And every now and then I find myself like yelling at Rachel Maddow because she's going on and on about, you know, something the president or one of his minions did, and why would he do such a thing, and how would he do such a thing? And it's obvious to me that she's coming from the context of, you know, like normal, reasonable, rational people who, you know, are you know, supportive of doing the right thing, would behave in such a way, and the president and or whoever is not behaving in that way. And she doesn't stop to question, like, in what context would that behavior make sense? You know, like, you can't just assume that everybody thinks the way you do, and or the way that and what's the word I want to use? That we all are coming from the same context or point of view. And, you know, sometimes it's just obviously clear that there's a different question that those people are answering with the statements of either their actual statements or their behavioral statements. We don't share the same assumed context. Hi, Kate, welcome. We're kind of partway into this. We've talked a bit about category assumptions, you know, that are part of our culture. And I want to also point out, and I think Lakoff and Johnson make this kind of clear in their book Metaphors We Live By, that there are networks. Our words are networked together so that when we use one word, say like the word good, it's got this network of associations with a whole bunch of other words. So what are the things you associate with good? Just kind of, you know, unmute yourself and shout them out.
Grief. That was purely a...
Okay, I wasn't expecting that one.
Good struggle.
Okay. Just everybody else, just what are your associations?
Excellent. Good. Moral, beautiful. Correct.
The Greeks believed that the good, the beautiful, and the just were all the same thing.
So what about things like up? Is good associated with up?
A lot of times.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is a shame because there's some good things down.
Right. Right. Exactly. That's the point.
Also light versus dark, good light, dark bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Good associated with the right hand and bad with the left hand. Or food. Sinister. Food, yeah.
Pessimist, optimist. Optimist is good. Pessimist, mm-hmm. Bad.
Yep, happy.
So, ambiguity or uncertainty is bad.
Right, yeah. So good and certainty. Yeah.
Knowing and not knowing. Knowing, knowledge and ignorance. Going back to, you know, that known and unknown grid that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, yeah. So there, yeah. Yes. There are those kinds of subtle assumptions that live in, you know, this is what I'm saying. They live in the structure of our language, but really they live in our culture. So I'm gonna skip over that. Yeah, our cultural values, you know, that we aren't necessarily aware that we harbor, again, are often because they're presented as, you know, just the way it is to us when we're kids. And then just keep thinking that way. You know, like bigger is better, or progress moves us forward, or higher cost equals more valuable. We talked about, you know, animacy categories, what's alive and what's not alive. Is very culturally based. Our relationality categories of what constitutes family. So let's take just a few minutes to think of a principle that you live by. And if somebody wants to state theirs, we can take a quick look at you know, what the assumptions are that underlie it. So for example, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Or what are some that you guys live by?
Kindness is not weakness.
Yeah.
Authenticity.
Can you state it a little more? Like, is there like an exhortation to be authentic?
Well, we're all members of groups. You know, I'm a school teacher. I often found myself in a community where I was at odds in terms of my values and my interpretation of education and how it should be done with the group that I was in. I often have a minority opinion. And so it became a struggle between which hill I was willing to die on. And some things I'm able to go along with, because if a group wants it, I'm not arrogant enough to think I should make everybody do what I do. But nevertheless, if you are caught always in, well, not always, but many times in a system where you are at odds with the authority or with the collective authority of a group, you feel where you divide and you have to decide in what way you can be authentic to your own values and how you can give Caesar what's due Caesar, essentially. It's an often a battle with any citizen and with anybody. I don't think this is just me, but I've noticed that since I was sort of born as a troublemaker in some sense, and it wasn't intention, no, believe me. But to be authentic, I had to figure out how I can maneuver in the world and be true to myself and be part of a community. It's tricky.
There, yeah, that's the statement. Be true to yourself while being part of a community.
Yeah. Easier for some than others.
Yeah.
And I don't assume I was right. I'm just saying that it's just the way I felt.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, the community also has to be true to the individual in a certain sense, like has to be respectful enough of that balance and that dynamic unity to allow the individual to be an individual and to allow, therefore, for the group to change as individuals change, because the group can't have a static identity and have dynamic individuals. If the group isn't dynamic, then, you know, as individuals, we will rebel against it. And I think that's a natural reaction, because we have the life force in us. We have the divine spark. So that, you know, that will not be contained, you know, by some kind of dead structure.
And that begins in the family structure. We learn how to be in community and individual in terms of our family of origin. And then it ripples out to other larger holes of concern. And I think that's what's happened in the world today is, Markle, you stated it, is how can the one and the many coexist and hold the tension? No, we got too many groups, like having egos, you know, just like individuals. And we've lost touch with that sense of dynamic unity. And I like that phrase, because kindness is not weakness, is very dynamic. When I act with kindness with somebody, it's situational, because sometimes the kindest thing I can do is take the keys from my drunk friend so they don't drive. And I have to be willing to authentically, going off of Kate, say, no, you're not fucking driving. It's going to harm somebody or yourself. That's dynamic unity to me.
I don't know if anybody else agrees with this. I see that there is the war that we keep talking about in the societal war going on is for control of the narrative. There's a tremendous war over who gets to tell the story. And I want to suggest, because many of you are sympathetic Jungians, is that if you don't pay attention to an archetype and develop it sufficiently in consciousness, it becomes demonic. You know, those archetypes within our culture that we haven't tended to are now demonic, and they are controlling the narrative, because that's the voice shrieking from both sides. And authenticity to self means that you are not going to be subsumed into that voice, that you're going to somehow figure out a way to think on your feet and not be pulled into the vortex of either one narrative or the other. I think that's what I feel most strongly about right now.
Well, I think we're struggling for a tipping point to have more individuals to think like us so that we can get on the other side of this polarization. There's a struggle. There's got to be a certain amount of a tipping point, amount of people that think like us to help others engage this way of thinking, because it's got to be a group and individual affecting the larger whole in the way I see it, because it seems to be the pattern of how life works from my limited experience for 66 years on this planet.
So I think this is a good time to transition into the stuff about complexes, because Kate brought up archetypes. And that's exactly where we're going next. So let me just go into, do I have the ability to share screen? Yeah, it looks like I do. Okay, let me just, these are a few little slides from a presentation on complexes that I did for our friends of group, and they really help to set the stage for what we're doing here. So just ask ourselves, what is a complex? Jung says it consists of a nuclear element and then constellated associations. Okay, and in the complex can be likened to a nested system that both contains subsystems and is contained within a larger system of, you know, one's life, one's culture, and so forth. A complex has an emotional energy charge. This is really important. There's an emotional charge, and the energy can be estimated in a number of different ways, like by the number of constellations it has, meaning the different ways that it shows up in your behavior, in your life. Also from the frequency and the intensity of the reactions. So, a complex, you can usually identify a complex occurring when you're having a reaction to something that is out of proportion to, you know, what a kind of normal reaction would be, like when you're making a mountain out of a molehill, for example. The energy is also the intensity of the accompanying effects, you know, like how big of an explosion does it have into your life? Complexes are, they're part of us. There's some complexes that are, you know, more benign than others. We have our ego complex. It's innate in your character, determined by your disposition. And there's also a factor in it that is determined by an experience, by something that you're reacting to in your environment. And the nuclear element, let me see if I can. So the nuclear element can be characterized by an archetype, such as the father archetype, the martyr, the fool, the victim. And likely there is also a wounding at the core of a complex or a secret, something you don't want others to know about you and or that you don't want to know about yourself. So this goes back to what we were talking about earlier about what you don't know, you don't know. And the archetypal core is associated with various images and emotions, symbols that are personally relevant, and there's a behavioral aspect to a complex. So the constellations over here are the way we see the complex. So when someone's complex has taken over their psyche, it can cause them to behave in ways that might not be appropriate to the context or even in line with their normal reactions. So to illustrate this, I'll tell you about one of my own complexes. Let me just come back so I can see you guys. So this was a complex that would show up in every like relationship with, a male bonding relationship, boyfriend. Since I'm not married, they've all been just boyfriends. And if they, suddenly go quiet on me, they don't return phone calls for some reason, or, in these days, texts or emails, I would panic. And I eventually learned that this response of their seemingly giving me the silent treatment went back to my mother. And when my mother got angry at me, she would go silent. In other words, she wouldn't, there'd be sometimes she'd yell, but the times that to this complex up to me were the times that she wouldn't yell, that she would just ignore me. And so so when anybody would stop talking to me, I would get that visceral feeling like, oh my God, they're mad at me, what did I do? And the reason why this was so impactful for me, like from the imprinting with my mother, is that eventually, somewhere down the line, she couldn't hold in her anger anymore, and she would just like erupt, and it would be like a volcano, and it would be awful, and she would like get really mad at some, she'd like hold this anger in, and 3, 4, 6 months later, it would all come pouring out in a much bigger way. So that was her complex. But what that did for me is that it took me a little while to figure out that her silent treatment was actually her expression of anger. And so to prevent the eventual explosion, you know, I learned to ask her, okay, why are you angry at me, Mom? You know? And when that complex showed up in my love life, okay, mainly with males more than my female friends, if there was a disruption of affection or a silent treatment or something, some form of behavior that I interpreted as the silent treatment, I automatically assumed that the other person was angry at me. And so I would ask them, why are you angry at me? And, you know, inevitably they'd go, I'm not angry at you. You know, why are you asking me this? I just, you know, I had a busy day at work, or I couldn't get back to you because, you know, I had this catastrophe at home, or, you know, some other very reasonable question. But meanwhile, you know, over here, I was like, oh my God, they're angry at me. We're going to break up. It's awful. You know, and making just a terrible mountain out of a molehill. So, you know, eventually I had to learn to tell myself that, okay, their silence is most likely because they've got stuff they're dealing with. It's got nothing to do with me. But the constellations are how it came out in my behavior, in my feelings of anxiety, of, you know, oh my God, why are they mad at me? Okay, let me go back to this thing for the next slide.
Hey, Lisa, just one note. I have a hard, yeah. I have a hard cutoff for myself at 11:30 your time. So I'm just going to duck out, but I'll make you the host so y'all can continue. Okay.
Okay, great. Thank you, Marco. Okay, so as I was trying to, you know, work through one of my complexes, I found this way of doing it. So there, I imagined it as space. Like, this is the space of the complex. So there are three axes, and each axis is a polarity. So there's a self-other polarity, and there's a mirroring that goes on between each of these poles. So what is that? One pole is mirrored in the other. And I'll show you how these are mirrored and interconnected so that you can use what you're conscious of to become conscious of what you're unconscious of, which are the processes driving the complex. Another axis is feeling and doing. Okay, so this is the feeling tone of the complex, and then the behavior that is associated with it. So the feelings are the energy charge that shows up, but there's always a behavioral substrate as well. Complexes don't just exist in the feeling realm. And then the third axis is the conscious unconscious one. So when the unconscious erupts into our feelings and behaviors, we can be more or less conscious of what is happening and what we're doing. So you know, early on, I was not conscious that it was my mom's, you know, conditioning that caused me to always have this reaction in my my relationships with men. you know, it took a few years to become conscious of these processes. And it takes some work to dig them up. But fortunately, you know, with the mirroring that happens, if you can be aware of this kind of mirroring, it makes it easier to see what's driving your complexes. And what I found out is it's often something that you yourself are doing, but like you're not even aware that you're doing it. So the telos of the complex, I think, is to help us become conscious of what we're not conscious of. But to get there, sometimes it does take us on quite a roller coaster ride. And here's the, let's go through the dynamics of one of my complexes to show you the roller coaster ride. So this is how I mapped out one of my complexes to become aware of you know, this structure. So in most of the relationships I've had with the men in my life, this pattern has repeated itself. First, there's after the honeymoon phase of infatuation has worn off, then the relationship settles into stability, and my psyche disrupts that stability by you know, projecting things into other people's behavior. Particularly, I would project a belief that I don't matter. Okay, and often there's some event that triggers it that has me feeling excluded, rejected, or ignored. So, you know, being excluded from a gathering, being ignored during the holidays, you know, things like that left me feeling kind of rejected. So now I would feel unworthy of his attention or affection. So there's a feeling tone, and I may not be conscious of it. Now, if I'm still stuck in the first response and being angry, I might not feel it. It's only after some introspection do I realize that, you know, my anger at feeling excluded from, you know, the gathering is actually this I'm not worthy belief showing up. So what I end up, so that's a trigger, that feeling that I have based on that belief I have about myself is a trigger. And I would then tend to discharge that energy kind of preemptively by rejecting him. So some of it happens, I feel rejected. That's the feeling, the feeling tone here. And then the doing that I would do is I would reject him and say, okay, we have to break up. And so I'm putting my feeling over there and acting as if, you know, he is rejecting me and therefore, you know, things are over. So this is that self other axis showing up, okay, is how I put my feelings over there into him and assume that he is rejecting me. And then, you know, I respond to that by preemptively like breaking up the relationship or something. So what I'm assuming what he's feeling, and you know, likely it's actually not what he's actually feeling. Okay. Um, So this preemptive rejection is so that I don't have to feel the projected rejection that I expect to come from him. Okay, so can you see this weird mirroring? I'm feeling a certain way. I put the feeling over into him. I assume he's feeling that way so that I don't have to look at it in myself. And I don't have to feel what I assume he is feeling towards me.
Lisa,
so this is, yeah.
Can I make a response to how you're laying this out? Would that be okay?
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So my feeling tone of listening to you,
mm-hmm.
and I actually go along with what you're saying, and I call it the funhouse effect. I'm lost in mirrors. You know,
yeah.
I'm lost in these mirrors, and I have to maintain, for me, my work has been maintained. I don't want to break every fucking mirror. I just want out of the funhouse. So I just want to point that out. Your description is landing on me, if that's okay.
well, that's very apt. Yeah. Because it is kind of like a mirror where things get really distorted. You're absolutely right. It's landing exactly right. I don't like be making you uncomfortable.
That's why I asked if I could just give you feedback. I'm not uncomfortable. This is what we're doing. This is what we're supposed to be doing.
Exactly. Okay. So all of this that I've been talking about here has been happening in the current relationship system. So the one with a boyfriend. Okay, now I happen to have enough psychological savvy to know that I should look for a precursor to this in an earlier relationship, most likely one with my family. So I trace the feelings of feeling rejected or excluded or being unwanted back to my family. I was the firstborn. I was the one that ruined my parents' wedded bliss, having been conceived a mere month after their marriage. You know, so I've made up that, you know, maybe they didn't really want me. Okay, so they're the stories from my family where I kind of felt the same way. And perhaps the extent to which my parents didn't express their true feelings verbally, but you know, nevertheless, as children, we still pick up those things. Being unable to differentiate ourselves from our parents, you know, we might co-experience the feelings, but misplace the attribution. You know, so it's not mommy is rejecting me, but I'm rejecting me. In you know, the complex. So anyhow, with my family system, which is the gray elements now in this little diagram, there's a kind of mirroring that happens on, you know, this primary self-other axis with similar feelings and doings. So let's look at that. In my family system, you know, I feel the same way as I do in my current relationship. I feel excluded, rejected, ignored. And yes, you know, I have a lot of, you know, I can tell you stories upon stories, you know, they didn't even invite me to the family reunions. However, if I look at my current relationship with my parents, and it was this way in the past too, okay? I find something kind of striking. I find, if I'm really honest with myself, that I don't particularly want to be around them. And maybe that's why they didn't invite me to the family reunions. If I'm super honest with myself, I consider them to be like unworthy of, you know, my time. And I am the one excluding or rejecting them. And behavior mirrors my feelings of being excluded and rejected. So that's the behavior feeling, the feeling doing axis being mirrored on in this other relation. So while I was being run by the complex, I was not conscious that I was doing this, okay? I thought I was being a good, dutiful, decent, loving daughter, you know, despite the friction with my parents. Once I admitted to myself that, yes, I am just as rejecting of them as I thought they were rejecting of me, I could then see how this unconscious rejection of my parents mirrors the more conscious and definitely more evident behavior of rejection that I was exhibiting in my current relationship, but temporally opposite. So, you know, having been rejected by my parents, although, you know, they might deny it, I now reject them. It's not preemptive, but reactive. So
that's the pattern that I discerned, that what I'm feeling in the current relationship, which is rejected, which was obviously a projection, is the conscious manifestation of what I was unconsciously doing in the relationship. My parents. Okay, so the reaction I have in my current relationship is by my doing it with that person, with my boyfriend, showed me, okay, and I was consciously doing it, okay, it showed me what I was unconsciously doing in my family system. So, fortunately, seeing this whole dynamic blew this complex out of the water for me. The preemptive rejection that I used to do, you know, I don't do that anymore. I see where it is in this whole pattern. And even though, you know, there's still a lot of things in my current relationship that, you know, haven't changed, you know, like feeling excluded a lot and not, but not ignored quite so much. I'm not captured by the complex. I'm not having those same kinds of like automatic overreactions. So here's how I kind of broke it down. You know, and if you want to take a picture of this slide or something, just to have it for yourself. Here's a way that you can identify, you know, complexes in your own life. So if you identify the two main systems, generation systems, you know, one is generally a current relationship and one is generally a family of origin relationship. Okay, and then identify what was the eruption, what happened, what triggered it, in which system did it occur? Usually it's the current system, the current relationship system. Okay, and then identify what was the feeling tone of the eruption. You know, were you feeling abandoned? Were you feeling neglected, rejected, abused? Okay, and then ask, you know, what was done? What did you do? What did the other person do before, during, after that particular eruption? Okay, so this is all these points, 2, 3, and 4, are all in the current relationship system. Okay, and then start looking back into the earlier relationship system that set up the conditions for this eruption, and look for what are the parallels between system one and system two, particularly with regard to what you're feeling and what you're doing, and what you felt back in the first relationship and what you're doing in that relationship, which you may or may not be aware of. This is where the key was for me. And then ask, in what way does the conscious feeling from one system reflect an unconscious doing in the other system? And so this is what fuels the complex to keep going and keep, you know, if you don't identify that, the complex will keep coming up. You'll still get constellation after constellation until you're able to see this unconscious thing that you're doing. And when you can see that, I think there's the chance that you can free yourself, you know, at least somewhat from an unconscious complex. So I realize it's kind of complicated and there are lots of moving parts. So, you know, if there's something, if you want me to help you, you know, like put these pieces together, you know, for complex in your own life, you know, just contact me offline. I'll see what I can do. But that's
an interesting map. Really interesting map.
Yeah, you know, when I did the presentation for the Jung group,
yeah,
I related it to the, what's that kind of attractor? It looks like a butterfly. The Lorenz attractor.
The Lorenz attractor.
You know,
what you use.
Yeah, because a Lorenz attractor, you know, it kind of spirals in one thing and then it spirals in another and then it goes back and it pulls these two, it's like those are your two systems, your current relationship system and your original relationship system. And it just, you know, it goes back and forth between the two of them.
It forms a unity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, your visuals on that were astounding. I remember it.
Oh, thank you. So, I do want to be aware of people's time, but if you have questions, I'll stick around as long as you want.
Well, I want to hear about somebody else's questions. Complex. I can just say out front that I know I have an anger complex, definitely. And when it explodes, it really explodes.
It would be interesting to go back and, you know, fill in the blanks of, you know, what's the feeling, what's the doing, so that you can become conscious of something you're not conscious of, so that you're not trapped, or that complex doesn't have you by the tail. You can have it by the tail.
Your complex really hit home for me. I was like, oh no, I have a very similar complex, I think. And it was very interesting to think about it in those terms, especially the unconscious doing in the family of origin that is the source of it all. That's something I hadn't thought of before, and it seems right. So thank you.
I'd have to say that it resonated with me because we're both firstborn. So that just resonated with me right there, being firstborn. And as I told my firstborn son, when he was kind of chastising me for how I treated him different than his sister, I said, well, you and I are firstborns. Our parents get to experiment on us. All the other kids get the results of what they did with us, you know? So, yeah, there's a lot of resonance with that. I would say that I like the map and stuff, but the way I've related to that experience has been informed by contemplative practice in Zen of meeting the behavior in the moment and being open to that unconscious, where is this coming from? Of being able to, in the midst of a certain intensity, actually hold the intensity and kind of be okay with it. And then certain things just, there's not as much digging into it. It just kind of heals itself in the moment, if I can put it that way. Because the more I behave like a certain thing of being excluded or something and feeling that, the more I bring a meditative mindfulness to that feeling and the intensity in the moment and relax around it, then my behavior changes, and with that behavior changing, maybe in this language, the complex just, I don't know, it changes it, my relationship to it. Without, you know, I'm not, you know, without going through what you just shared, which I totally like how you shared it.
Yeah. Well, if that's sufficient to calm the complex down, you know, not just at that moment, but for future moments, that's great. I wasn't able to do that, to that level, to calm it down. I could calm it down in the present, but it would keep coming.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how much of the complexes have common source in feeling powerlessness and shame.
Oh, a lot.
Powerlessness and shame are kind of the condition of childhood, you know?
Yes, yeah.
And then the fact that I respond in anger and Lisa responds in another way doesn't maybe argue against a common source, but to be able to get on top of a complex, and I'm just thinking of my anger complex, getting at the root within it, which would be shame and powerlessness, is a rather large work. It's not like I go, oh, it's just because I felt powerless. Well, that's over, you know. It's so hardwired into you, even in your physical body. And to go after that, I think, is not a light work. But I was unaware of my complex for years, and only really recently became aware. It was obvious to everybody else, but oh, really?
Yeah.
Not to me.
Well, part of my work has been through, because I've been traumatized, And when you bring the work of trauma and what they understand without necessarily having been in contact with Lisa's model, I get the model and I totally, as on a mental level, but a lot of trauma work is starting from the bottom up and actually being able to allow yourself to acknowledge and feel the shame without trying to put another layer of shame or get angry because you're shame or, you know, it's stripping away the extra layer and just working with the bodily experience that has mental stories that go along with it.
But don't you have to have something to replace it with?
No, no.
Because
you don't have to, you do not.
It's not comfortable.
You don't have to have anything to replace it. What you have to do is be comfortable with, I don't like to use that word because actually you have to be able, or you're training yourself to be able to, and to move towards the uncomfortability, the intensity, and teach yourself a new way to relate to it. So maybe that's what you're replacing, is the way you relate to it. That's probably a better way, you know, that I would share it. It's having an effect on how you're relating to your own experience, wherever it came from, even from your past, you know? And
the way I would suggest is if you're feeling like a worthless worm, you know, probably continuing with that idea is not a constructive thing to do. You replace it with
the I would challenge that because I think I would challenge that because part of the trauma work along that, because that is in terms of trauma, that is one thing you have to work with is the sense of shame brings a sense of worthlessness. But in terms of trauma, very small, very gently, you allow that experience to be there and help you know you are not that experience. And part of that is challenging. Do I have to believe that fucking story that I'm worthless? But you can't change the story unless you kind of give yourself permission. Okay, that's what I'm experiencing. That's part of my experience. What you're changing, I think, is the knee-jerk reaction that you get into a spiral. If I hear what you're trying to indicate, Kate, is you trying to, with trauma victims, they're trying to teach them there's a hypervigilance that they're trying to get them to settle down. And they have to turn towards it, but in small, gentle ways to know that, yes, you were traumatized and it's leaving an echo that is affecting you now. You kind of have to just sit with the echo and show, oh, that's an echo. That's not necessarily what's happening now. And it is a training, and I'm not trying to dismiss how hard it is, but because I've been through the training, maybe I just am enlivened by the possibility that it even exists, if that makes sense.
Following Gabor Maté?
Say again?
Have you been following Gabor Maté?
I followed him, but more Peter Levine and the Parley Vega nerve research and a lot of stuff that is trying to get people to actually learn to live in their own skin because we are affected by the outer world and stuff. And it's not to dismiss the mental, but as a book that's influenced me called In My Grandmother's Hand by Resume, a black somatic therapist, is that he's trying to change the culture that until we actually can be with each other's trauma experience in a way, we're not going to change racism. It's too mental. We're trying to do something that we're not acknowledging that it's actually in our body culturally.
You know, Michael, one of the images that came up when you were saying that is what you're talking about is the solidified form is probably like ice. And then when you're working with it, you're dissolving it a little bit at a time. So it's not replacing it. It's just releasing it to go into the body and to rearrange the energy or whatever it is.
Thank you, Rick. That's actually what I was trying to point to. You didn't get it. I agree.
Go ahead. Quick point. There is a necessity to when you get down to finding out, you know, what it is you're doing that mirrors the feeling you're having. It's usually something ugly about yourself you do need to own. You know, like I needed to own how rejecting I was being of my own family, of my own parents. And I think it's that thing that we're trying to keep unconscious to ourselves, that when we finally own it, you know, and make it conscious, or in the opposite order, we make it conscious and then we have to own it. That's where the release from its grasp happens.
I just wanted to say hello to Michael, actually. I actually know you from Riverside. I went to one of your meditation classes one time. So, and then I would see you in coffee shops and we would talk about philosophy. So it's good to see you again.
You're muted, Michael.
Thank you so much. I just didn't want to make presumptions. You looked like who I thought you were.
Yeah, it took me a while to realize who you were, too.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure.
And could you pronounce your name? Because I'm not sure of it.
Well, the full name is Micaela, but Michaela. I usually go by Mika.
Mika? Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Are you still in Riverside or are you somewhere else?
I'm not. I'm in Monterey now, which is actually where I am from. So.
Well, beautiful place. I would rather be there than here.
Yeah, I'm pretty lucky to be here.
Thank you very much.
Where are you, Michael?
I'm in the Inland Empire or Southern California, where it's basically desert, you know?
Riverside.
Yeah, Riverside, California. Anyway, I wanted to, Lisa, that's it. I think what's important added to what we're saying and that I learned from trauma, and even if you're not traumatized when you're doing this work, I think it's really important to be gentle and take baby steps. And the more you take baby steps, then you can, you build a certain ability, or you strengthen your ability to create a container for it, if I can put it that way, some kind of way of holding whatever's arising. And Rick's metaphor comes really in handy because I really like it, because it's not about doing away with anything. It's just changing the makeup of the solidity that was stored at a certain point in our bodies, because we do store energetic. I mean, it's not just bad things we store energetically. We store even joy energetically. And, you know, sometimes we forget that how joyful it was to be a child, you know, and see the world anew. So and that's why I say kindness is not weakness, because that's been a mantra of mine in working with this stuff, is to be kind with myself. It's not weakness. And to take my time. But also kindness has an edge to it when out of your kindness, you have to kind of make an effort for yourself, or you have a friend that you need to call them out. And yeah, you're risking something, but in terms of a sense of morality, I'd rather risk not being a friend than finding out I did something that caused harm to himself or somebody else, given the circumstances. It's very situational.
It's all in all. That's true. Like this Vipassana meditation helped me realize how, yeah, the all the sensations and the observing pleasure, that we seek pleasure, reject unpleasant sensations, and it's also the our avoidance. It's all, yeah, I had a very, very powerful, well, you know, there's Vipassana, that's the, they say, sankhara that surfaces. So you observe and then there is would be in your body certain, it was like very physical. You really, I had that here, very strong sensations that it just gripped me so and wouldn't let go. And I finally like was sitting with them and observe, brought so many memories of all. It's like it made me cry because it's like, it was so, but I, and it took me so much effort to just observe them and dissolve and surface. Yeah, like, and I had a, for the first time, not that long ago, I realized that I had anger that was so suppressed deeply in me. I really thought that I didn't have anger, that I forgave everyone. I really thought that it was, but it was just very deeply suppressed. And how it started surfacing, and it, yeah. And then you, it's really like something ugly about yourself. Oh yeah, like you have to face that, all this, which is normal for everyone, yeah.
Yeah, and I have to say the tears are the melting of the ice.
Yeah.
The tears, the gift of tears. Oh, yes, it's, yeah, the melting of the ice.
Yeah. Thank you all for going on this journey with me.
Thank you, Lisa.
We have the opportunity to do these more, you know, get out of our heads and get into our bodies with these workshops. So I'm thinking though, and I'll put this to Marco, it's a bit, the idea was to have the workshop, you know, shortly after the session so that things are still fresh in people's minds. But it might be a bit much for me to do two in 1 week. So I'm thinking, and, you know, give me some feedback in the, you know, the chat emails. If it would be okay to, you know, keep the discussions every 2 weeks, but then after the second one in the intervening week is when we do the workshop. It would be, you know, we did session one and two, session three, session four, and then workshop two in the following week.
That would be better for me also.
Okay. Well, everybody, you know, if you have an opinion on this, just let me know.
Works for me too.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm game for whatever the schedule is, because I have enough of a freedom that I can just plug it in. So whatever you come up with will work for me.
Yeah, for me, Tuesdays and Thursdays are the best days.
Okay, yeah. Great. All righty. Well, thank you all.
Thank you so much, and Lisa.
Next time.
I want to say I do appreciate, you know, all of the things you say in the email threads. I apologize for not being like really on top of, you know, staying in that this last couple of weeks, but my work schedule has just been, you know, like crazy. Looking forward, it shouldn't be nearly as bad. So I look forward to being able to stay a little more current and involved in that as well.
I was wondering, the title on your is N-O-B-U-S, Nobus? Is that Rick?
Yeah.
Yes.
You posted about Moore, right?
Right.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I was thinking about that post. I give some new directions.
Yeah, the article goes on and ties him with Wittgenstein, and so it deals with language a lot. So
yeah, I'm going to go back and read it. Wittgenstein is the philosopher that kind of brought everything to a frozen halt in philosophy.
Well, they moved the focus to language, and so then the question becomes, are you losing?
Yeah.
What are you losing when you focus only on language?
I only have a rudimentary education in the history of philosophy and jumped ship and went to the crazy side with the Hermetic philosophy a long time ago. So I have only a fragile grasp on the terms of
philosophy. Well, I'm a tourist, so I just want read these articles and kind of pick it up that way.
Oh, that's lovely. I find that I want the most dialogue, and it may be impossible to get, but I am so tired of the mainstream press and the other side, which seems to be completely unhinged, that I can't seem to find narratives on the cultural crisis going on with a group. I know everybody has an opinion, but it's kind of dangerous out there. And you don't find anybody much willing to go between the two opposing sides. But I think we're in for a real crisis in terms of our culture. And so if anybody knows a good narrative, a dialogue to become involved in, I'd be interested, because the only thing I've been doing to relieve the stress of being in this situation, because I'm so angry about the way things are playing out, is I just write letters to different newspapers, or you know, I write, which of course go in their trash can, but it gives me an opportunity to at least work through some of my frustrations. But I would like to see narrative that stretches across topics that where people violently disagree or are holding, you know, they're gonna die on this hill or this one. And I think we are in a war of archetypes right now. A lot of it's unconscious, and we're really going down with the ship. Lisa said something about throwing your anchor in. And I think my point was that when you try to find yourself grounded and you notice that a lot of your own ground has dissolved, you have to come up with what you truly think, because there is no other grounding except what you believe. And beliefs are decaying. We don't really know where there's solid ground. At least I don't.
It so is
I'm looking for narrative with that.
It is. It does seem to be the case that our culture in this world is in a free fall.
It is.
I'm going to offer a different language, languaging, which has more to do with non-orientability.
Very good.
I'm always bringing Klein bottles in our modernism meeting. Klein bottles are non-orientable structures. Their inside flows into their outside. They don't have a top or a bottom or a, you know, it's non-orientable. I we're going to a new consciousness where we
You're breaking up a bit, Lisa.
Yeah.
I'll see you. Okay.
Sorry about that. So just briefly, I think are the new consciousness that's emerging will require us to be more comfortable in that non-orientable space. We're going to have to give up our usual, what do you call them? Lampposts, guiding lights, things that helped us orient and be able to orient in a different kind of space.
Well, and that's going to, part of the challenging, just going really, kind of going deep with that, is that our bodies need to feel orientated. It's a primal thing, even in the womb.
You get psychotic. And so what, you know, you're psychotic.
Yeah. What I feel, I agree with you that we need to realize that our sense of orientation is being challenged, and challenged to such an extent it can lead to, you know, a sense of psychotic or nervous breakdown or whatever. So I want to hear about this new language, because I think part of new consciousness, if we're going to use that, is going to involve a new way of relating to the body at the same time. The body is not getting out of, the body is not going to be left behind. It's just going to change with the new consciousness, I feel. Maybe it becomes a Klein bottle. That's what it comes.
Maybe it already is.
Thank you. Okay.
That can come to it, isn't what I want to have is a structure. It's mostly just what I don't want as part of the structure. I mean, that's the best I can do. I don't like social contracts as they exist. I don't like the fact that all of the institutions in our civilization are corrupt and corrupted by money. And I don't like the fact
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you, bye.
So anyway, I know that I'm way off, I'm off the farm, but thank you. And if anybody has any good podcasts or any suggestions for me to go to for this
I have one, and Lisa knows who I'm talking about, Jeremy Johnson, Mutant Podcast. Jeremy Johnson, Lisa. I think that would be a good one for her to tie into.
Yeah, Jeremy is the president of the Gibser Society.
I'm gonna write that down. What was that again, Michael?
He has, Mutations Podcast, Jeremy D. Johnson. He does great podcasts. He just wrote a book, Seeing Through the World, which is his take on Gebser, right, Lisa?
Yeah.
For a young person, I'm in awe of him. He's just an amazing person to listen to.
Yeah. On the political front, Kate, Brett Weinstein and Heather Hying.
I listen.
You do? Okay.
I'm living with someone who's way off the edge in terms of their worldview, and they, my daughter Sarah, and so I have to admit that might have some influence on me, but I'm appalled at the condition of the world, where we have shut down the society to the point that we've driven people's jobs and businesses completely out of order, and that there is, it is much more destructive than any virus could be, and no one is willing to acknowledge what it's doing in realigning wealth. And that's really what I'm frustrated that nobody seems to be. And those topics are not allowed for the most part. You can't talk about the lack of a firewall between the CDC and Fauci and the pharmaceutical industry. You don't get to talk about how money moves that way. You'll get deplatformed for even approaching that topic. And no one is going to talk about whether 5G is healthy or not. There's not even a debate because they won't let you talk about it, which makes me angry because I'd like to know more. And I wonder at the topics that you're not allowed to have more than anything else. And they're quite, it's quite rigid. The media is controlling the conversation to a great extent. I don't know how you guys feel about that, but I'm highly suspicious of that.
The Weinsteins take up a lot of those conversations that
some
are not allowed to be had on mainstream platforms. But keep talking. 20 years ago when I started talking about how, we're all connected, people just kind of looked at me strangely, and now we've even had a, presidential candidate, Marianne Williamson, talking about such things. And so, just keep talking.
Yeah, I agree. I think the only good thing the only optimistic idea I can gain from my present situation is that it's like a piano falling downstairs. It's not going to lose momentum, and it's unsustainable. What we're in is unsustainable. So there's going to be a conclusion one way or the other. And I'm somewhat terrified of the mob, but I don't think that the powers that control the world in the sense that they do now. And I don't think of it as a monolithic, fist, but the ethical structures we live in are unsustainable.
Well, and that's true. And probably what we're going through, that's why it's necessary. It's necessary to go through this. And you said a piano. It's interesting you use that, because I took a tractor over a side of a hill. And so I very viscerally know what it's like to go with a tractor down the side of the hill. And I think, without presuming, Kate, resonating with the fact that when the tractor was going over, I thought I was dead. Now, the fact I didn't die left a very interesting thing to work with. And so a lot of where I come from is what I've learned from coming out of that very intense situation. And that was 20 years ago, and then where we're at now, and a lot of it without, I'm not going to take sides. It's just, how do I personally walk in the midst of this chaos?
Yes, Ryan.
And not contribute to the fucking chaos as best as I can, because the chaos sometimes lands on me and I have to respond. And so part of my recovery, and I call it a soul recovery, because I think my soul just took a reboot. My soul was rebooted out of that. And now, how do I bring forward and how do I interact with the world with everything? I don't disagree a lot with what you're saying, but how do I respond so that, because the polarity is everybody is, it seems to me, there's the, whatever side they're on, they're not understanding or willing to work with the real fear in a healthy, together way. There is a real fear, but the way we're relating to it.
If your livelihood's taken away, you can't pay rent and you can't buy food, you're likely to have a rather strong opinion about that. And we're putting millions of people into that situation.
Exactly.
It's not like I can just say, oh, well, I'm angry that people don't see this pandemic as that this is a rational response to it. I can't be, because the people who were pulling the levers, they send their kids to private schools and they complain about working at home, but they have a job.
And exactly, that's where I am. I am with you on that. I am with you of the disparity of the way this pandemic has put in the crosshairs the health of living human beings and economics. But it's interesting. it's interesting that this intersection, if we take kind of her, you know, earlier, the mirrors and the polarity, you know, I think it's an, I'm taking a philosophical view. It's a necessary kind of moment to move the ball wherever it's going to go forward.
I won't argue with that, but I'm arguing with the fact that the people who have the political power to design things either are just flat evil or they're too stupid to live.
Because a little bit of both.
This is not a good solution for people. Yeah. It is and not a good solution.
Kate, I totally agree with you, but the fact is, for me, I'm speaking for me.
Yeah.
I don't give a fuck about the powers that be because I have no fucking control over them. It's just like with my family. I learned that at some point I had to stop depending on my parents. They were good people, but I had to challenge their use of power and I had to deal with it. And I love them and stuff, but it's that one, because what you're activating in me, and I'm not, that's okay, but this is my activation, is that it, because of what I've learned, I'm not gonna go down the road of feeling powerlessness for something I can't control. You're absolutely right. I like to slap the shit out of everyone, and I mean on both sides of the political party.
Me too.
But I have a family, I have friends, I have this local environment that for what I've learned is if I can not ignore the global, but my actions have to take place locally.
Well, I can't get back to my house. I'm locked out of my house.
Oh, that's
I can't go home. I'm stuck without a home, without a job, waiting for these guys to figure it out. And it's like, it's so transparent that they inflated the numbers, inflated the death count. They're constantly telling me how scared I should be. And it's just making me progressively more angry. You know?
Exactly. And I think in this case, your anger is justified in terms of saying, anger in terms of saying enough is enough.
Yeah.
You know, so I really resonate with your feeling tone of where you're coming from. I guess I'm just coming from what I've learned to do with that feeling tone, if you understand.
Yeah, I do. And I appreciate it. And I agree with you. It's like you cannot give people that much power by saying that they have it because they don't. I guess I'm more angry at a collective bunch of people that act more like sheep than they do like people.
I'm actually that's where I'm going. That's one. It's the citizens that need to wake up.
Yes.
We voted these assholes in.
Yes.
So this is a good rant. We're having a good rant.
Thank you so much for today. It's just a great, I'm having a great time with your course. I hope I didn't get too far off topic when I went on about the salt point, you know, me and the salt point, but it seemed to relate anyway.
I found it interesting.
Oh, thank you.
You're muted. There you go.
Yeah, I want to spend more time with that article. Thank you for sending it.
Oh, yeah, you sent it to me originally.
I did?
Irony.
Oh, my God.
But it is. It's fabulous. It's fabulous. Okay, you guys, I'll see you later.
Bye.
Okay.
Thank you, Lisa. Bye. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.